In the state's ongoing campaign to address drug addiction, the corrections system represents an invaluable point of interaction with New Yorkers who could benefit from services that would help them overcome substance use disorders. But in practice, it doesn't appear that the Hochul administration is maximizing the opportunity to address the addiction needs of incarcerated New Yorkers. For more on the issue, we're joined by Spencer Norris, a reporter for the online nonprofit news outlet New York Focus, which examined the availability of drug addiction services like medication-assisted treatment at the state's prisons and jails. Welcome to the show, Spencer, and congrats on the reporting.
Thanks, Dave. Great to be here.
So I touched on it a little bit in the intro, but why is it important for correctional facilities to serve as a point of providing medication treatment for a substance use disorder?
I think that a lot of people are not aware of the fact that prisons in the United States have effectively become one of the most important institutions for providing medical care for a lot of people. The fact that a lot of people with substance use disorders have been dragged into the criminal justice system means that they are sort of at the mercy of the carceral facilities that are holding them when it comes to whether or not they're going to be able to get treatment. So New York has tried to take a proactive approach to this. It's one of only a handful of states in the nation that provides medication-assisted treatment within the carceral system. Medication-assisted treatment is a collection of different medications that are used to treat opioid use disorder, the most common ones being methadone and buprenorphine. Buprenorphine is a medication you can get a prescription for, and it's supposed to handle all of the cravings and the withdrawal symptoms that you would normally go through if you're actively addicted to opioids. The thing about this is that based on the data that we obtained through a records request, it seems that the carceral system, particularly the prison system in New York, is not giving equal access to everyone to these medications, which are important and can save lives.
Yeah, and you note in your reporting that a 2022 law required prisons to provide medication treatment for substance use disorder. So based on your analysis of the available data, what does compliance look like?
Yeah, and I do want to emphasize that, again, New York is one of only a handful of states that even requires these medications in prisons under law right now. That's a pretty significant step. However, based on the data that we obtained, it doesn't look like all of the facilities under the Department of Corrections in New York is providing the same level of access to the medications. Based on our findings, there was one facility that, over the course of 2 years, did not enroll anyone on the medication-assisted treatment program. Another facility in upstate New York only enrolled one person, and there's a handful of others that have only enrolled single-digit numbers of people on the medications. Based on the academic research that's available, it's estimated that about half of the incarcerated population in prisons nationwide suffer from substance use disorder. So it's highly suggestive that these numbers are not reaching the actual need within the prison system. Additionally, in our reporting, we found that just 10% of the people receiving medication-assisted treatment are Black, despite the fact that half of everybody in the New York prison system is Black, and despite the fact that the single highest risk demographic in the state right now for an opioid overdose is Black men.
And one of the things that stood out to me from your reporting was this idea that facilities could reject applications for treatment. Any sense of why facilities were rejecting applications? Was it a case of not enough staff or resources to meet those needs? Is there something about those candidates? And when it comes to rejecting applications, is there a threshold or standard for prisons to follow, or are they left with a lot of latitude, and if so, is that a problem?
There's a lot of things that are still opaque about the way the system operates.
In New York's prison system, you're telling me there's opaqueness? That's pretty hard to believe, Spencer.
I know, it's a real shocker.
Okay.
Based on the data that we obtained, all it said for the rejected applications was that medication-assisted treatment was not, quote-unquote, clinically indicated or medically indicated. What that suggests is that they determined after performing a physical examination of the potential patients, they determined this person doesn't actually need medication-assisted treatment. the thing about that is there is no objective test for whether somebody has an opioid use disorder. This is a judgment call that comes down to medical staff or somebody's practitioner. Docs knows this. This is in some of the memos that we published alongside the story in which we obtained from our records request. All this is to say that there's myriad different reasons that they could have rejected people for these medications, but we certainly, based on the data that's available, it does not seem like there is an equal level of access to the medications and equal rates of enrollments. We found multiple facilities that had 99% acceptance rates and collectively enrolled hundreds of people on this program. Contrast that with, I mentioned, the Adirondack Correctional Facility. They only accepted one person to the program and rejected an additional 14 people. So there are serious questions about what kind of judgment calls are being made depending on who are the decision makers when it comes to whether or not somebody's going to get access to this treatment.
Well, before we move on, let me reintroduce you for listeners just joining us. This is the Capitol Press Room, and we're speaking with Spencer Norris, a reporter for New York Focus, who did a story on the availability of treatment for drug addiction in New York State's prisons and jails. So when it comes to the actual oversight of the decision-making by prison officials, is this something that just falls on the central command of the New York State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision, or are there other state agencies that are at least tangentially involved in this type of thing that have some sort of oversight?
So the Office of Addiction Services and Supports has a stake in this. They are there to provide technical oversight. They're there to advise docs on how to actually implement these programs. But when we reached out to them to ask them about this, they said that, look, we don't really have an oversight role in this. It largely seems like all of the actual oversight for this falls within docs. They're sort of responsible for policing themselves at some level.
And does that seem like that's something they are capable of doing? Can they be their own watchmen?
Well, I think that gets into a broader philosophical question about whether any state agency should be its own watchman. This can become a real problem if you are responsible for determining your own metrics for success and you don't have any kind of outside scrutiny. I mean, this is just a fundamental problem in how the system is set up.
And in reporting this story, what sort of response did prison officials from the state give you to explain the different engagement from one prison to the next?
Their response when we asked was effectively that, well, you know, some people at certain prisons might just ask for the medication less than at other locations, which to a certain extent that could be true. But the differential that we saw in terms of the number of people that were asking and the number of applications that were viewed suggests there might be even a problem in terms of, you know, how do you even ask to get on this program in the first place? I keep coming back to the Adirondack Correctional Facility. On average, that facility holds somewhere between 110, 120 people at any given time, and there's turnover in that facility, right? So when Doc says, you know, we've received 15 applications over the course of 2 years, I mean, that does raise the question, well, did people even know that they could access this program in the first place? Additionally, I spoke with an addiction treatment provider who pointed out that there is a racial component to this as well. She said there is a very long history where it comes to sort of a racialized war on drugs, right? This is something that we're aware of and stretches back to the 80s. So it's not really a surprise that a lot of people of color would be hesitant to admit to the prison system, I think I have an addiction and I need treatment for this. There's a long history of mistrust there that also could be limiting how comfortable people even are telling correctional officials, I need help.
based on your reporting, which includes some past stories in 2023 about the Sheriff's Association, whose members are responsible for running the state's jails and their effort to basically kill a bill dealing with medication for opioid addiction in jails, does it seem like prison officials more broadly are well-suited in terms of temperament and expertise to do something like this?
You know, back in the napkin, you would like to say so. The fact that DOCS is going to be significantly better resourced than a lot of county correctional facilities suggests that they're in a better position to connect people with treatment. Mm-hmm. But this also comes back to a whole question that a lot of advocates have about, is this even the right way to be connecting people with treatment in the first place? Carceral settings were never originally intended to be medical facilities. And there's all kinds of issues that you run into when you try to graft medical care onto a carceral setting. So they sort of raise the point, again, why are we trying to solve this by placing people in prison and then trying to get them treatment instead of focusing more on diversion?
Yeah, and when I think about the officials working in these prisons, they are primarily tasked with the idea of keeping people safe and keeping the population that they serve in that facility. And it seems like anything else could be a secondary concern. If that is a secondary concern, I wonder how much emphasis they're putting on it when they have other priorities.
Certainly. I mean, in fairness to the people that work in these correctional facilities, they were there to be corrections officers. They didn't necessarily enroll to be medical staff. The prisons do hire separate medical staff in order to handle a lot of these tasks, but the guys that are sort of interacting with the prisoners on a more regular basis, kind of day-to-day, they were not necessarily trained to have a high degree of expertise in a very complicated disease.
So over the last year, you've been doing a lot of stories in this space more broadly, and I'm curious what it's been like to do that beat. Is it something that you enjoy doing? Do you gravitate to this for some reason? What's been your takeaway as you've looked at this from various perspectives?
I would say that this has probably been the most gratifying beat I've worked as a reporter. I do have a little bit of a personal connection to this. This is something that has affected friends and family, opioid addiction. Even with that kind of background, I have been sort of continuously shocked by some of the things I found out. There were just additional layers to this that I was not aware of. Certainly, a lot of aspects surrounding how the carceral system decides to handle opioid addiction was not something that was really on my radar until I really started to dig into this. I think a lot of people can be forgiven for not really being aware that this is happening.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Spencer Norris. He is a reporter for New York Focus. You can follow him on Twitter, whatever it's called these days, at Norris_report. Spencer, thanks for visiting us in the studio.
Thanks, Abe. Really appreciate the time.
Support for Capital Pressroom comes from Ørsted and Eversource. South Fork Wind, America's first commercial-scale offshore wind farm, is powering New York with clean energy. More information about the workers, businesses, and investments that made this project possible is available at southforkwind.com.
And by Better Buildings New York. Better Buildings New York supports clean, healthy, zero-emissions buildings and thermal energy networks. It's in favor of the New York Heat Act. More information at betterbuildingsnewyork.org.
Join us again for Capital Press Room, a production of WCNY Connected, Syracuse.